Institute. Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Your ultimate culinary companion.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Okay, so welcome to another episode of Dishing It Out with me, Gareth Mullins.
And me, Gary O'Hanlon.
And today we have a lady coming in, Santina Kennedy, who is somebody that's working in the world of Irish foods. That I know a little bit through socials. I've never actually met her, but Gary done an event with her quite recently, and we're going to get into talking about her life and food and all things Wicklow, I think. That's what the neck of the woods that she dances in, so I'm really looking forward to that. And then we'll have our usual bits and pieces, our culinary conundrum, our cookbook. Tune in. So now we have that time, new piece in the show, where cookbook of the week. This week it's Gary's Twist. So Gary, what have you got for us?
Yeah, actually it's more a range of books, right? But I suppose you can also go one in particular, but Ottolenghi. If anybody's familiar with Yotam Ottolenghi, his restaurant is in Notting Hill. If anybody's ever been to the Ledbury, I don't know if you've been to Ledbury. I've been to Ledbury a few times, right? But on the way down to the Ledbury, you'll actually pass. I think it may have been...
It's not there anymore, right? I mean, he's not in Notting Hill anymore, the Ledbury. It's moved up into London now, isn't it?
Might well be, is it? Aye, it's moved to a new location. But anyways, Notting Hill, made famous by the movies. A lovely little neck of the woods, anyways, in London, worth going to. But Ottolenghi... One of the things he got most famous for was his meringue, like his raspberry, it's basically like a raspberry ripple meringue. And Ottolenghi Sweet, which is one of his books, you'll see it.
It's literally unbelievable.
It's literally this big, white, fluffy, and he has a really unique way of actually making meringue too. It's like the egg white is almost done au bain-marie over a pot, almost like you're making a hollandaise. Like there's loads of different funky techniques. But there's also one of his books, it's like a red cover, just like Ottolenghi cooks, like right back as far as 2008. I mean, he must have 20 plus cookbooks. Ottolenghi Simple's another one, but Sweet and Simple are two to look out for. Absolutely unbelievable. He also has a test kitchen, like we've often talked about it on the show here, Gaz, about recipes that work, like Jamie Oliver's, obviously, like he's got a big repertoire of recipes on there because they're tested. And anybody, like, it takes a lot of money and a lot of expense. Anybody that ever makes recipes or like us or creates videos or creates recipes for a living all know the cost of ingredients and the time and the input, the documentation to do it right. Because no matter how simple something is, if you're going to make it right, it needs to be measured to the point, whatever, of a gram, especially when it comes to pastry. So it's essential that they work. And that's one of the big selling points, I think, of Ottolenghi.
He's known as the king of flavour, right? Because he uses all those high citruses.
Yeah, well,
tahinis.
I think he's from Jerusalem or around that neck of the woods. Like, and all that sort of Middle Eastern. It's very aromatic food. Like,
and not always spicy, so.
Not at all.
And why you like it.
And that's why I like it. You know me. Like I have no gauge for spice. I can't handle much spice at all. I love spice, but it's just my tolerance to it. It's gotten worse and worse, and I absolutely crave it and I love it, but I can't enjoy it because it just overwhelms me. But all that Middle Eastern cooking, it's more aromatic. It's got real, real depth of flavour. And as you know, we're obsessed with, and every chef should be, not every chef is, but we're obsessed with flavour. But he's just got an unbelievable knack. There's some really cool recipes and stuff, and it's everyday kind of cooking. His restaurants or the food that he's involved in as well, it's all that sort of daytime, relaxed, simple. Not so simple, but lots of techniques used to make everyday simple dishes. Unbelievably tasty. And so yeah,
have you eaten in Israel?
Oh yeah many times.
I've never been.
Specifically gone to London to eat his food years ago and learn how to make those big fancy meringues, like lovely. So yeah, check out Ottolenghi Sweet, Ottolenghi Simple. And then when he's got his own site, and when you're on there you'll see a full list of cookbooks. Honestly, Every one of them has something different, and they're all incredible.
Yeah, he's worth a follow on Instagram as well, because he shares loads of recipes on there. So
yeah, fabulous cook, yeah, no, fabulous.
Yeah.
Okay, so it is time to introduce our guest for today, and it is none other than the 2025 Blasna Héireann producer champion, all round. I'm amazing, Santina Kennedy. How are you? I met Santina a couple of years ago. I never came across you. I was cooking the Taste of Wicklow, I think it might have been. Right. And I was driving down and down and down and down the country. And then I rolled in and I met this lovely woman. And you stuck in my mind that day. You know, I says, God, it goes, I really enjoyed chatting grub with that woman. I'd never met you before. Mm-hmm. And then I would have probably come across you somewhere outside the K Club, leaving with handing me a bottle of whiskey, because we'll get to it, but you were at Powers Court for a while. And then last year you curated what I can only say, I've been talking to Gareth about it, was easily the best event I've ever seen, food wise, culture wise. You know, we really like to celebrate St. Bridget in the K Club. I do a food and wine event every February or that bank holiday weekend. But in the lead up to it last year, you came in and got some people from different walks of life all together. And I have to say, it was one of the most special things I've seen happen out there. And it just elevated you in my mind from that day forward. So thanks for coming in to dishing it out. It's great to have you here.
I'm delighted that both of you have asked me, Gar and Gary and Ed. Thank you so much for the lovely welcome. My head's not going to fit out the door after all that. I hope. So we've started. Can we just finish there? Well, quit there. But thank you.
So you're full time in this now. What were you doing? So give us a wee bit of background on what you were doing before you immersed yourself in the wider food world.
Yeah. So I suppose I've always been interested in food and working backwards from where I am now. I've been a little over a year freelance consulting now. And before that, I was at Powers Court Distillery for 5 years, a role I really loved. So it was hard to step away from that.
What when you say Powers Court Distillery, though, like, was it doing tours? Were you working on the whiskey, or was it more about the experience there? Like, what happens there? I've never been. I don't drink whiskey either. I wish I could.
They do Johnstown Beef do some.
They do. Yeah. They do a beautiful, beautiful aged whiskey.
Yeah, exactly. Bullen.
Yeah, absolutely gorgeous. What was I doing there? I suppose my role at the end was like PR and advocacy and running events and PR events. But really, I suppose my main piece of work there was curating and developing that food and whiskey pairing tour, and experiences and events around that, and really showcasing whiskey as part of the overall Irish food and drink culture and scene. Yeah, and really kind of placing it, because we're really good at celebrating our drink culture in Ireland, and we think of, you know, two particular drinks, but we don't really think of it as part of the overall celebration of food, drink and hospitality. Mm. So that was really the rationale behind that. And then I really, in all of the work that I've done...
Can I ask you a question about that?
Yeah.
So did you do any, like, there was obviously tastings going on there, but did you ever do any dinners where it was like people were drinking whiskey throughout a dinner?
So we've hosted dinners not only on site, but also, you know, off-site dinners.
Why did you never call me or Gareth? Like, why we never cooked these dinners?
I was holding out. So, especially for a launch of a new whiskey, that would have been part of it, you know, to incorporate whiskey into a meal.
And it was kind of a loaded question, because I've been thinking about it. It was a couple of guests I do 4 or 5 wine dinners a year.
Yeah.
And I have a couple of guests asking me to do it. But I'm always nervous, and I'm probably being a little bit ignorant here about the alcohol consumption of how I tie it. Like,
I did the Macallan one last year. They approached me to do one. I did 6 or 7, but
like, you know,
well, there was a cocktail on arrival.
Okay, yeah.
And then there was a couple of whiskeys.
No wine?
No. No, it was all whiskey-based stuff, yeah.
And it's really fascinated me since I entered the world of whiskey, like the difference in flavours. You kind of think, and you have people saying, oh, I don't like whiskey, but they've tried one, you know, very low-end whiskey maybe in their entire life, and that's turned them off. So
there is a bit in it, right? There is a bit like in learning how to taste wine. you know, most people's idea of whiskey is that they might have drank it too quickly in a shot, or they've had it with Coke, or they've had it where when you're talking finer end, it's
they associate it with a taste of vomit.
You associate it with maybe a hard night out. And I don't know why. The thing is, people persist with, you know, everyone starts with cheap cider, cheap beer, cheap wine, and they persist. So I don't really know why people don't persist. And you know, it takes a little bit. Yeah, maybe. But it takes a little bit more, maybe just consideration and education around whiskey and the different flavor profiles. But whiskey works really well with food, and it works really well with Irish food.
And is there any ingredients or any things that you feel like it's a match made in heaven? Like, I don't know, like wine and cheese.
Well, absolutely. Like, the thing is, when you think about Irish food in particular, it's very fatty. It's like really richly, like the cheeses are really rich. Butter, like
a cream.
Beautiful saying, the Irish saying, you know, that what butter and whiskey can't cure can't be cured. You know,
never heard of that.
Yeah,
oh, cool.
But when you think about it,
but doesn't beat the rice one. You got to give her your rice one. Rice, it's born in water, but it must die in alcohol.
This is your risotto recipe. I heard that recently, and I actually really love cooking risotto, and I think that's really one to remember.
Oh, my risottos are outrageous.
But certainly, like, and but things like Irish charcuterie, you know, I've used a lovely one from Meath, you know, the wooded pig. Like really, really high quality charcuterie, with lovely. And because the high alcohol content just cuts through the fat. Beautiful. There's a beautiful pâté producer in Wicklow, Le Paysan Thierry is his name. He's French, does his old French family recipes.
You never guess what his name
Not sure you have to tell us that.
He's from Bray. His pâtés are incredibly creamy and delicious, like the alcohol just cuts through those. So anything like that works really well. Whiskey and venison. Beautiful.
Yeah, I was going to say venison.
Gorgeous,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And it lends itself to smoke so well, right? Because a lot of whiskey has characteristics of like the wood and the smoke.
Absolutely, and like smoked cheeses and, you know, a smoked fish and all that sort of thing. Sometimes it can be too much though, so you do have to sort of really taste
it. You have to balance it,
A lot of tasting went into that.
Yeah,
project,
well, that sounds so, like it's awful work.
Yeah.
And then from before that then, I mean, if you're working backwards?
So before that, working backwards, I did what I would call a life-changing experience. I did the MA in Gastronomy and Food Studies with Martin McInamara over in TU Dublin. And absolutely loved it. Before that, I had
how long did that go on for? Like,
it was 2 years. It was 2 years. It was my first time back to college. I had done a food science diploma just to quickly be able to access the master's, because I'd come out of, like, I'd been at home with my kids for a very long time, and then I'd run a cafe for a very long time. So when I closed that, I was thinking, I've got 20 years here with no experience to go into a new job.
You had your own cafe.
Had my own cafe.
Where?
In Enniskerry in County Wicklow.
Good town. Nice.
I loved it. I grew up there. So I did great, really great support. And it was the real locals hangout. It was,
aren't going too hungry around there.
They're not going too hungry.
No, cheap territory, is it?
And it was a great place to open. And I really wanted that place to be the kind of hub for local food. And I had things like a 5 mile fridge. And like, it was the most loveliest compliment anyone ever paid was soon after I opened, and somebody walked in one Saturday morning and said, this place is like West Cork. And I was like, this is amazing. Opened on a shoestring budget. Like, it was my family kitchen table. We had no bookshelves left of the house. They were
they are the best gaffs. I always remember the first day I met Frankie. It was the 5th of February 2009. We had a lunch in Restaurant 41. Graham Neville was the chef at the time. He's in Dax now. He's a friend of the show, but he's never come on the show. He will be on, but he's probably universally the most respected chef in the country. And we were there anyway. And it was a Eurotokes lunch. But over that lunch, Frankie Fish was talking to me. He was up in an Amport Moor, and it was just a couple of grand, him and another boy who he ended up buying out after a few months when he realized there's only enough beans for one of us. But there was no fancy design, there was no this, that, and the other. It's like, there's a lock of grand just to get the doors open.
Yeah.
And then it has to work.
It has to work.
And it has to work. Viewmount House was the same. I'll never forget it.
And what did that look like? Well, like, was it just in starting off with coffee and scones?
Actually, when I started off, I'd intended to open a food store, and I was really thinking, because I'd just been thinking about this for so long that we just weren't celebrating Irish food.
Right.
And I grew up in Enniskerry, surrounded by farmland, you know, and you see the seasons happening, and it's such a lovely thing, you know, to have that farmland all around you, and sowing barley and cutting barley and cows grazing. But I realised when I started to travel that other places were celebrating that food and we weren't.
Yeah.
We weren't looking forward to when the lamb would be ready or what, you know, where the milk's going from.
I think it was I think people were doing it, but we just weren't telling the story correctly.
Totally, yeah.
It was happening. Exactly. Right? People were looking forward to lamb. We just weren't.
But it was not, didn't know like what farm it was coming
from. Yeah, right, okay.
So I just had this idea that Enniskerry was the place where I could, you know,
harness that.
Support those local producers and harness it, and that it would be a great, I didn't even have the words food tourism then, but you know, that was, and that's what it was. And people were so supportive. You know, it's really supportive. It was a family business. I mean, my children, who all have a great work ethic now, and that's because they have spent long hours being a supporter, and
they'll all thank you for that, you know, now.
They certainly do. But it was, the vibe was lovely. When I closed it, actually, and it was a long, big decision to close it, because it really was a social hub. And there was one particular table that were, you know, everyone used to sit, the locals used, table five. And I set up a table five support group, WhatsApp group. And you know, 7 years later, that's still the most active WhatsApp group on my phone. Yeah. And people who never knew each other before that,
And what was the thing that really brought people back? Was it, you can tell us the food thing, but was it the sense of community? Was it the sense of seeing familiar faces?
I think so. We had a really gorgeous coffee, and I kind of knew that the coffee had to be good.
Oh, yeah.
So people would, you know, I drive out of my way for coffee, and I'll find parking if I have to.
Yeah.
So I knew the coffee had to be good. And I, you know, the local food, I suppose.
On that, though, isn't it amazing how many gaffes will open? I don't drink coffee, but Nettie's an aficionado. But they just try to go cheap, like thinking, well, I'd rather make more money. Like, how stupid can people be?
It's
like,
knowledge, but, you know, people that
or is it just
naive? Yeah. Like, they just don't understand.
They don't know.
The skill
same
behind.
With food.
Yeah.
I'm like, do it right.
Yeah. Well, if anyone's listening, I mean, you travel the N4 a lot. I travel the N4 a lot. If anyone's listening, could you please open somewhere really gorgeous that sells coffee on the N4? You know, because it's just, I will drive out of my way for coffee, but I prefer not to.
And what was the thing? What was the dish like? Was
the
it dish?
So it was.
Was it
was
bread. Was
yeah. It was.
It was
really sandwiches, really high quality. We had bread from the Bretzel Bakery. We had great local cheese. As everything from Wicklow at the time as we could, as much as we could. The local eggs would come in, but just that sense of community. And I suppose everything that I've done since, and you're talking about that lovely event, which I loved curating, and I really loved curating those events. But I think everything comes back to how is the person going to feel when they're having this?
Yeah.
And it's not even, you know, that you're waking up in the morning thinking about that, but you know, you guys know when you're cooking and when you put real love into it, that's the stuff. And but when you see people enjoying it, you get the energy back.
You brought Salt Rock Farm to me that day. Like, I was already deep in the thought process of cooking for my peers. The Eurotalk AGM on the last Monday in February, the 24th of February, I think it might have been. And I was just, I was like going, geez, what am I going to do for that dinner? And there was one or two wee bits of the courses that I was stuck on. I'll make my own butter or do whatever. But then they had a yogurt and I got to talk to them about that and bits and pieces. But I was just like going, Jesus Christ, like how has she found a farm that, you know, I pride myself on knowing it. We have our, you know, ear to the ground and we kind of know of anybody worth knowing. But I hadn't come across them. And then your woman started crying nearly.
They have been producing milk for quite a while, but they just started butter last year. But they're fabulous. But I suppose, like, I have such a nerdy interest in this stuff. Like, my ear is so close to the ground. I'm practically on the ground. You know, and
I was impressed, though. It was
the constant banter in our house is absolutely hilarious. Like, what's she going to have in the fridge today? Yeah. You know, the amount of times they open the fridge and go, what is this? You know? But I think, you know what, it was a combination of those things. I think if you get the food and the drink right, no matter how simple, and the hospitality right, you know, everything else, you know, as she says, as the economies everywhere are in collapse. But I think if you get those three things right,
but
they're the main
ingredients. But I think the real conundrum that's going on at the moment is, even if you get all those things right, you might not be on the road to success because of the rising costs, you know.
Yeah.
And even if you've got
absolutely
incredible service, amazing
absolutely
food.
Yeah.
really great cooking.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I absolutely described that time as the best possible way to scratch a living. Like, we were literally, like, I was working 6 to 7 days a week. My whole family were involved. My poor dad retired and he was down doing kitchen porter listening to Joe Duffy. You know, I mean, it was just everybody chipped in. You know, even my customers, I had to move premises at one stage because we just really quickly outgrew the premises we were in. And there was an old chipper across the road and it needed a bit of work, but it was ready. And some of my customers just came down in the evening and just helped me scrub the floor to get the place ready.
Yeah.
I
mean,
they're the people that I think are food champions.
People really do, though. Especially if you're in a town or like Longford for me, I walk in through, I live in Granner, but I walk through Longford town and I meet people. They're so grateful for what I would have done or the restaurant James and Beryl did for the town and the county. Not just that it was nice when they went there. You go into Matt O'Brien's to buy a suit or get whatever, or into the other boys down the street or businesses that you know. They have this affection you were always in the media talking positively about a place that was never, ever... People really, you know, these businesses, whether it's your cafe, whether it's him in the marker, like these businesses really matter to the people around them. It brings life to towns, and it, you know, so many people, you'll have loads of kids that would have made coffees or cappuccinos for you or baristas.
References I write for kids who worked for me seven years ago.
I bump into girls now, like they're accountants, two of them are doctors, some are in medicine, lots of them are teachers, there's a load of teachers, but these were all 17, 18 year olds when the rest
it
was
is, it is slightly mad. Different for me, because like when you work in a big city, because I remember when Evan sat there speaking about, and I've often heard people saying that like he employed half of the people from Black Lion, they went through and I've often heard people telling that story about Ballymaloe and you were talking about it now, you've spoken about it before. It's not like that when you work in a big hotel in Dublin, right? So, and that's one thing. It's a different part of a food story, but it is different.
But you know, if you delve into it, there's still a handful of local boys.
Don't get me wrong, Gary. There's a lot of people that use the anywhere I've worked locally.
And the K Club has Straffan, as big as we are.
Yeah.
Like, I pop down. I always try and go in. I mean, I need to be eating in the restaurants or eating around the kitchens. I make it my business to sit and eat in the staff canteen at least twice a week. But like, it's brilliant to be down there now when the greenkeepers, the summer boys, are in getting the course ready for the Irish Open. And it's just full of Straffan boys. And when I worked at the Chateau in France, there was two or three. I just have an affinity to Straffan anyway, because Anal, who was my boss over there, Scotty, these boys are Straffan boys. But they all start, their first job is the K Club.
Yeah.
For anybody growing up in Straffan, you're gonna carry a golf bag at some stage or a plate or a glass of champagne.
That's absolutely true. People feel connected to that. And actually, just on that, my daughter's boyfriend actually lives around the corner from the hotel where you are, and he was saying,
there you are now.
I know that hotel. You know, that's we're really proud of it, you know. And so, and it does actually stand like a beacon in that part of town.
It does.
So people are proud of it in ways that I suppose you probably wouldn't be hearing as close to the ground. You know, but the mothers aren't coming in saying, daughter in transition year, a job or work experience.
And so before that, then, have you you obviously made a decision to start this cafe, but were you in the world of food before?
Not at all. I was raising my kids, and before that I was 9 years in Ulster Bank, and that was not a natural career.
You were a dirty bank.
I was. you literally wouldn't give me your wallet to mine, let alone your money. I can't find anything. I can't find my own purse. So it was, you know, the 90s, and it was a job, and you know, you took having a job seriously, but it was never for me. It was a bit too confined. I have too many tabs.
I can only imagine annoying you would have been, like, in a 9 to 5 in a bank.
So I somehow wriggled my way into a role that involved walking around talking to people with a clipboard. So that was
deadly.
Just close to my personality. But at the time, we were all very grateful for jobs in the 90s. But I don't have it back. But I've always been really, really interested in food. And, you know, my mum worked hard, as did my dad, you know, and we'd, growing up in the 80s was great, but they were modest times for everybody and not a lot of money. And I would raid the kitchen presses and come up with these concoctions. My mother would come home from work and like the whole week's groceries would have been into this meal that I'd put on the table for her, you know. So I have to credit her with just not getting too cross about that and leaving a mighty mess in the kitchen. But I've just always really interested in food and felt like I grew up in Enniskerry, and it is a tourist village, really, with Powerscourt there. So I suppose even growing up, we were aware of, and not in a kind of, you know, that you're waking up thinking about it, but you are aware that this town is living on farming and tourism. Now, it's very much changed now, but that was how it was. So you're kind of important. Know that it's important to be nice to people and you know, and that farming plays a role. So I somehow all of that came together, and I just wanted to go, you know what?
But you obviously, there was part of your business mind that's seen a gap for
couldn't, there was nowhere really that I wanted to go for coffee. Yeah, and yeah. Also nowhere, and it's changed now, of course, it's very busy with coffee shops now, but there was nowhere that I felt that I could kind of go and hang out. But as I said, when we started, it was just food, and then immediately people were going, you do coffee, and then the coffee came. And then they were like, it was all takeaway, but no one ever took it away. They just stood there. Yeah. One day I counted 27 people standing up at the counter having a cup of coffee and thought, we need to get seats.
So it's like you're in Milan or something.
Except everyone's having big long lattes. No one's having an espresso and moving on. Yeah. But it was great.
Now, is everybody, like, it's obviously, you know, to go from, I suppose, full time to then your own thing.
Yeah.
Like, was it a big long jump? Like, or were you... were you worried about the volume of work that's out there? Like, is there, now that you're in it a while, like the freelance world and the food world, there's an awful lot of people that's kind of mingling around in that space
there is,
a while.
There is. And I think, so look, when I was at Powerscourt, I was also part-time coordinator of the Wicklow Food and Drink Network. So I made a lot of contacts through that, and I still am, and I still feel very passionately about the kind of rising tide for all counties, really. I just happened to be in Wicklow.
Yeah.
But so people were asking me to do events with them, and I couldn't because I obviously had a full time.
You had a job. Yeah.
So I thought, look, the time is now, and I was worried, but I also thought, I've done as much as I can with this place. I can't go any further. You know, time's ticking, and I need to, if I want to do other things. And I really wanted to get into that space of celebrating food and culture, and not in a really highbrow way, but just to make people realise food, and really good food, should be and is accessible to everybody. And so are those other cultural elements and things that you think, you know, I don't like whiskey, or I don't go to the pub, or I don't go to the art gallery, or those things, to connect those things through a common medium like food. And I was thinking, okay, when I finish up at Powerscourt, I'll take a month off and I'll think about who I am. Mm-hmm. No,
yeah.
I literally, I wish. I didn't even get to Greystones. It was just like immediately, oh, I hear you're out in the wild now. Will you do this? And because every morning I was saying, I've no salary now.
Yeah.
I was saying yes to absolutely everything, which was wonderful. It was really wonderful. But now I'm kind of, and that's why I'm so grateful you asked me.
Learning as well, I think.
I do have to kind of go, okay, who am I? Who am I? Not to be thinking too deeply about it, but like,
yeah. But you got to put a value on your time.
Mr. Boucher's long.
Yeah, exactly. I was actually thinking, like, this is such a moment for self reflection. But yeah, so I need to kind of go, the stuff that I really really love doing, and sometimes that actually is that stuff to leave for when I win the lotto and go, you know, and then there's other stuff that, you know, does value what I can do. And I think my elevator pitch is going to have to get shorter, and I really need to define it now. But certainly developing those food experiences and events where people can enjoy food. I don't even want to say themed, because sometimes that sounds so superficial, but where you can take
conceptual,
an idea.
Like,
where you take an idea and you sort of go deep into it. And I suppose the Bridget's Day events that I've been doing, because I'm a big fan of St. Bridget, her being the patron saint of dairy and brewing, like she's the OG ambassador for food and drink, concerned. But taking the idea like that and all of her many facets and talents and turning that into something really immersive, you know. And like those, I did a series with Blanca Valencia in the art gallery, plates and palettes series. And that, I just loved that, because you're, you know, again, people sort of feel, oh, the gallery's not for me. But actually, the gallery's for everyone, and we all own it. Yeah. And you should go in and enjoy it. And if you can also have local small producers celebrated on a menu there, everyone's a winner.
Yeah, but
you'll have to come in and have our afternoon tea.
I'm coming in with Sinead in a few weeks. I can't wait.
It's based on poetry and places, so that's what we designed our afternoon tea on. And it, like, those type of things, they take so much time that, like, and what I always find is when I'm being asked to do something And sometimes the people in marketing or whatever, they want you to come up with it really quickly.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, I can't.
No.
I have to just let it sit. And I have to let it sit with my pastry chef and whoever else is involved in it, which I understand can be frustrating because we want to keep driving on. But when you do allow time, and sometimes I get frustrated with myself because it's not happening. I don't know about it. Maybe that's what writer's block.
But you have, but you have that, like, as a chef. Like, there's days, I've said this before, probably on here, I sit down and write new menus or new dishes, and I could just be shooting them out three, four different restaurants at the K Club. And then there's another day I'll sit at my desk and there's just nothing in there. Nothing. Like, you're like going, I couldn't put wine and cheese together the other day, even. Like, there's nothing coming out of my head. So quite often, chefs love lists, and I'd just be scribbling dishes. Mm-hmm. Like, there'd be pages beside the PC, it's just dish after dish after dish. And then there'll be a day or a moment or the weller or something will affect it, and it makes its way on. But as you say, someone telling you, come up with a brilliant idea that we can sell loads of afternoon teas, and now, like today, you're like, come on.
No, it really does take time. And I think when people see the final event and they sort of think the event is that 2 hours, but it's actually like months of thinking.
But that's also okay, I think, if people are in it.
Oh, no, completely, completely. But I suppose it's definitely the people who are selling the event, like, think that this is the bit that work is done. But that bit is when the work is finished.
Yes, it's done.
But it does, and I definitely find, like, not to be all, you know, philosophical about it, but when I'm completely switched off from thinking about it and
that's
out for a walk or something, that's when you really go, oh, do you know what, it'd be great there, and it just comes to you, you know. But it's lovely. It's a lovely space to be working in. But I have noticed that Places in Poetry Afternoon Tea, and I rang my lovely pal Sinead Smith and said, we need to do this.
Yeah, no, she was on to me about coming
in. So I really can't wait to do
that. And we actually, I had another guest that was in, it was actually a girl I used to work with 20 years ago when the Marion was in for dinner in the restaurant. And I went out to chat to her, and she was sitting with a girl that does a bit of poetry. And it's kind of, not the concept is done, but it wasn't really evolving much. And she asked, would it be okay if I done a poem? And I was like, yeah, of course. So anyway, we sent her all the collateral and all the menus and everything. And she came in and she wrote a poem about the afternoon tea at the hotel. And on the National Poetry Day, she came in and recited it for all the guests that were in the bar that day. But there was a lot of international guests there, and they were like, mind blown is the word.
Yeah.
No, that sounds
No.
But as mind blown as I was listening to this girl who went away, spent this time and energy talking about something that,
and you're like, geez, I'm a great lad, I'm after throwing this really together.
Isn't it so cool when different collaboratives clash?
Yeah.
Because that's what it is, right? And I'm really interested when you can get food and art and alcohol and anything.
No, it's all those kind of creative tendencies, I suppose.
Yeah, or music.
But I also think that poetry is having a moment as well. People are seeing poetry and food as well.
Well, in Viewman, we had poems in the breakfast menu. We always had
gorgeous.
A story. It was gorgeous.
You probably
would have stayed and you would have read it. Yeah, it's deadly. But that's why you're even here, because I go back to the St. Bridget's thing that day, and there was the different people doing the different stuff.
Well, she's the patron saint of poetry. So
yeah, but there's just so much.
I need a pen there. Yeah.
There's so much.
I can listen back.
There's so much going on in Ireland that you, like, it's incredible. You know, there's people making stuff here, there, and everywhere, and creating stuff, whether it be poetry or whether it be, you know, an ornamental thing or whatever it'll be, whether it be butter.
Yeah.
And cheese
craft,
and yogurt
and
whatnot. There's craft everywhere. And it was really, and obviously it was all women as well, I think. Am I right?
It wasn't intended.
Oh, the brewery boys were there, they?
And
Rye River.
Dewdrop.
Dewdrop.
Yeah, Ronan from.
Yes.
So it was mostly women taking part in it. And we actually had a couple of men on the guest list as well, but only a couple were brave enough to come. We did have a sound bath at the end of it, because Bridget, the goddess, was also the goddess of healing.
Can anybody see my face?
Gary had to attend to something in the kitchen at that moment, so unfortunate. Yeah. But that was, it actually was really moving. So and you know what? I just love
I'm not
they did ask
I'm
me that I want
to be hypocritical here.
They did ask you to stay.
That to me, I don't know.
Shannon was like, do you want to stay for the sound bath? And I was like, it's a hard pass.
I set in on, we done a retreat thing in the hotel there. And
fucking goodbye, look at you.
There was an exercise piece, then there was a Pilates class, and I finished with a sound bath. Mm-hmm. And I found it really hard. I just found to tune out. Yeah, to be honest, if I'm just being really transparent, I thought it was a lot of nonsense.
I'll change your mind. I know the girl who changed your mind.
It was amazing. I really enjoyed the fitness piece, and I enjoyed the.
Yeah, it's a step too far.
It was actually a very good friend of mine beside me. He was he's been here. John Belton was beside me.
Yeah, yeah.
He's actually from Wicklow.
Oh, really?
My nanny would love that shit. Yeah. So would Denise.
But she was there as well, and they enjoyed it. But me and him are like two scratching cats.
You get Audrey O'Connor. She's just amazing. But I was in that sound bath moment, and it was actually the first time I'd experienced a sound bath myself, even though I'd booked her and seen what she'd done. But so I was sitting there, so I was like really relaxed, and then thinking, oh God, the Irish coffee's outside. Yeah. The Irish coffee's and all the K's will have flown.
That's what was happening to me, because I was actually preparing lunch while the lads were preparing.
So I couldn't really.
I need to do it again. We need a sound bath. How
do we get that
Actually,
that'll be an amazing way to finish this.
A sound shower, maybe.
Exactly.
Like the world's gone to the dogs. Like it really has.
I'm going to have to think of something really clever now for next year.
You are.
But I just think.
And was it really well received?
It was really well received. Yeah, it was.
And were you sitting for it? Or?
So we were sitting. So they were on chairs, like this beautiful room in the K Club. Yeah, yeah. And Audrey came in, and she does such, like, the setup was so beautiful. But I was watching as she's putting these gorgeous candles on this little beautiful rug. And I was like, oh God. Okay, but she's totally in control.
Did she sing also?
She didn't sing, no. No. We know singers, actually. But they've always been beautiful events. I have to say, when you go into a place, and this is not just Plumos for you, Gary, or the K Club, but I think when you go into a place where the setup is completely professional and you bring great ideas to it, and then great people help, and when you've great hospitality there, and everybody really commented on that. So I suppose they're just interesting ways to get people into spaces where they have a mindset about what a particular place is like, or a hotel or a restaurant's like, and you kind of can lure them there with something interesting.
We have an art installation at the moment. We've engaged with an artist who was down in Kildare Village. Well, the art cellar was down there, and she's placed all this amazing art all around the lobby. And I love walking through the lobby and I see somebody looking at something.
Yeah,
you know, from a guest point of view, I'm like, man, that's so
Gareth and I are very similar, you know, like we take great pride in our places of work, you know, whatever. But like that day in particular, I mean, I'm very proud to be the executive chef there anyways. Like, but leaving the K Club that night after that whole event day, like I was floating up the M4. Like it was just like on that. That was just every guest that was there today, every point, from drinks, from welcome, to the carpet, to the lights, to the temperature in the room, to the sound bath even was legendary. Everything was just proper hospitality. It was unique, it was different. And I was like everybody left there today with an experience. Like it was just magic, you know what I mean? And art's another one too. If speaking about art, right? Four Seasons Hotel in Lisbon. If ever you want to go, I think they even have a brochure for their artwork.
Really?
It's one of the best hotels I've ever stayed in, but they have an unbelievable art collection. Same, even the K Club, we've got the Liam O'Neill stuff, a lot of it up around in the Henry Lounge. And God, it's just, you could go. I'll be looking forward to that in America.
And I used to hear people talking about art. And I'd be doing
rolling the eyes. Yeah,
I know.
What are you going on about? And it's only like, you can't tell anybody that. Yeah. And I think I told this story about we were in Budapest, and we went into St. Stephen's Basilica with my kids, right? Yeah. Zach is killing me for telling this, but he's 17, nearly 18 now. And we were in this park, and there was another church, and I was like, we'll go in here and do the curtain up. And the kids were looking at me going, we're not going in there. I was like, come on, it was a small church. And because there was a curtain, I thought they were hiding something. So I was like, I bet you there's something really cool in there. Yeah. So we go in, right? And it was like white walls, few benches, got totally ripped off, had to pay in, I had to tap to get in, right? And it was a scam, right? So anyway, we went in, and I came out then, and Denise was like, that's your last time. But then we were in the centre of Budapest, and they have this St. Basilico's, St. Stephen's Cathedral. Now, I mean, this place is mind-blowing when you go into it.
Wow.
And we walked in, and it's like all hand-painted ceilings, marble as far as the eye can see, and the two kids were in there, and I was like, just try and look and take it in and all. And my daughter was, in fairness to her, but Zach was like, It just wasn't interesting. So then at the other side, there was a glass box with a hand in it, and it was your man's hand that was preserved. It was mummified or whatever.
Nice.
And it was when there was some war or something went on, yeah, and it was blown and his hand was found. And I seen everyone came and I said, right, they'll find that interesting, right? So I was like, come over here and I'll show you this, right? And he was like, what is this? I says, look, just come over. There's a few people in front of it. And he looks in and he goes, oh, yeah, that's handy. And I went, my work is done. It was a cracker. Man,
good man, Zach. Boom, boom.
Yeah, exactly. Pop me rapping.
But you know what? He'll remember that.
And I will.
He'll be in some conversation in 30 years' time where he has to pull some artistic notion out of his head and he'll go, oh, I remember when I was visiting. And he will not mention that bit.
No, but it's these are the things that, like fine art and music and, you know, and being dragged around places when you're younger. And only now you look back and go, that was actually quite special.
I didn't appreciate it. But even if you can get them to remember, just file this for later because you will remember this later. And like some of it is so austere or so like intimidating. I mean, an awful lot of the time I don't understand. I go to an exhibition, I'm looking at it going, what is going on here?
Yeah.
But you know, I think just to not be intimidated and to go, you know, this is actually for everyone, especially very strongly about places like the National Gallery. It's for everyone, and just go in and enjoy it for you. Yeah. Even just being in the space is so beautiful. Yeah, you know?
It is. Well, look, we always wrap up an interview with death row dinners. So,
as you know,
and we've had all sorts. You've been a listener to the show, and Pizza actually made an appearance recently. Nevin's famous 85 course dinner or whatever. What are you eating for your last feed?
I have this conversation with myself and to whatever unfortunate standing beside me, like I'd say twice a week, this is the last thing I ever want to eat. I have to say some things really stand out. I was at the Cager Fields a couple of years ago doing that tour of this like really prehistoric farming site, and it was in January. We were absolutely freezing and we were out in the bogs for about 2 hours looking around. A fascinating tour. And we came back in this kind of community hall and we had a beautiful bowl of vegetable soup and homemade brown bread and butter. And to accompany that, we had Cager Mountain Lamb that was just cooked over coal outside on the barbecue. And I will literally never forget that mouthful of. And I just think those simple things done really well are amazing. I was in.
Was it a pureed vegetable soup or was it a brothy one, broth, like barley and broth?
And chunks in it. And it was freezing outside. We were all wet and damp and we came in and just even the welcome was
I'm going to make a broth tonight. That's what I'm going to do.
Just gorgeous. But I, you know, one day I'll say, oh, it's a, you know, a Sligo oyster or then. But do you know what? I was in a restaurant the other night and this beautiful bowl of spuds came out with the dinner. It was gorgeous. And I just thought, oh, there's no butter on the table. And if we were at home, we put butter on this. And then I was thinking, why don't, like the first restaurant that puts on new season Irish spuds in season as the dinner, a bowl of spuds, a plate of butter and some sea salt. Like,
I eat them. If you ask anybody in Kelly's Hotel, Eugene, who's been the chef down there for a lifetime, and Bill and Laura, like, you get new potatoes in their jackets most nights. But when I eat there, it's every night. They don't even, there's no contest now. They just bring out the spuds. And I'm with you there because my old boy's been brought up here many's a time. Like the old boy used to judge how good a dinner was or how many spuds he got, you know.
But we're very
and how far early, yeah. Cares Pink's like Donegal spuds, nothing beats them. Just cooked in the jackets. Like I look forward to it when I go home all the time. With you there,
yeah.
I don't take the butter though. Funny now, Nettie does. I just salt, man.
I feel the same. Salt.
I'm loads of white pepper. Like I put like a layer of white pepper.
You talk
on
about white pepper so much that I've actually really started using it again in the kitchen.
A white pepper, white pepper is the greatest seasoning known to.
But I just think like I love fine dining and I love theatrical things and I love the silver cloche and like that Bridget's Day dinner that you did at the Cade Club. Oh my god, that was amazing. Those like whatever you did, those pork scratchings that you deep fried and deep fried, they were incredible.
Yeah.
And I love all of that. But I do think that we do simple food, like proper food.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of work in, so the, in the pork scratchings.
Sure.
Yeah, you got to cook them and poach them for hours and then dehydrate them for 12 hours. And then you deep fat fry them and they puff like a prawn cracker.
Just,
and I finished the pork dish with them. Yeah. What
they
a
were,
chef.
But the thing about... Hold on a minute. Sorry, I interrupted
you
there.
I'm talking yourself
in the back.
That.
Oh, fucking
but the thing about really simple food is that a lot of the time it's not really simple.
Yeah, that was
totally
the point
that you're talking about.
Oh no, completely.
Super
and,
correctly.
And, yeah.
You know, that's the point for it.
And you know what? I have to say, and this is not to sound too ethereal, and I haven't had too many sound baths, but I think when you have somebody who is
that's some of the sound baths, I feel bad on that girl.
I'm definitely going to change his mind. When you think of, you know, a farmer who is putting like such effort into keeping pasture, keeping livestock, like getting it to that abattoir is really close.
Yeah, yeah.
So to have a local abattoir, you know, so there's a
it's
low stress animal,
it's butchered correctly.
All of that, but all of that good energy that's gone into that, and you give that to a chef who's going to take the same care, and someone who's serving it in a way that they, you know, they really want you to enjoy it. All of that—that's really good energy, and you're tasting that as well. Does that sound like?
No, that's amazing.
Don't take the good out of the lamb dinner. Jesus,
And you have to give us a dessert now that you've spoken so wonderfully about.
Dessert,
the
I love. Like anything lemony or citrusy. Oh, I love something sharp, but like, again, something like rhubarb. And you know what? If my kids know that I'm going to be in bad form about something, they will make sure that there's a Cologne rhubarb yogurt in the fridge for me.
Very good.
You know, and actually, that's when I say
Cologne farm yogurt.
Oh my God.
There's
oh,
no
creamy.
The Wexford rhubarb one is the so creamy.
Unbelievable. I actually like their, I like the lemon curd.
The lemon curd one's
lemon
a daddy.
One is
it actually makes your face win.
It hurts the jaw. Like,
but when
jaw.
I see the words Wexford rhubarb on it, then I just go deep into the sense of place and taste of place, but I absolutely love them.
Yeah.
And like
Cologne Farm, the consistency in the yogurt, like I get annoyed at watery shit natural yogurt, you know, but Cologne Farm touch
it's just
your recipe.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah. So I've had and I am a dessert person and I'm a cheese board person and I love desserts and I love like really fun desserts. But I think again, something sweet, like if it's lemony, yes, but a sharp, but like a sharp Irish fruits.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, look, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you. I really enjoyed that. I really enjoyed it. Thanks.
Right, Eds, crack out the sound bath.
Boing. All right, guys. Santina was good old crack there,
Brilliant.
Wasn't she?
I mean...
You never met her before?
No, I hadn't. And you know, it's a slight little turn on some of the pods we've been doing as late because it was very, very foodie-led.
Mm.
You know, I mean, we don't always have people that are solely working in the world of food. So it was a lovely conversation. And I mean, she's obviously really, really, really into it because you could see every time she went to talk about an ingredient or... She spoke about her cafe or she just lit up. With
yeah, she did.
Enjoy,
yeah.
You know?
But you could see why she's now creating a nice career for herself
for
the world of food. Like, she's a pleasure to work with. Bright, bubbly, intelligent, and the knowledge to back it all up. Like, and she truly wants to showcase these producers. It was no surprise to see that she got a nod from Blast the Heron, who do things right as well. You know, like they really do single out people that are making a big effort in the world of Irish food. And I was delighted to see her get that. But again, it makes all make sense when you meet her and you're chatting to her. And we just seemed to laugh there for 20 minutes.
Yeah, it was good fun.
Half an hour. It was good crack. So yeah, thanks for coming in, Santina. That was deadly. So it's Culinary Conundrum time.
Culinary Conundrum Corner. Yes, that was me just jumping in. It's Ed Chef here. Load of great questions have been rolling in at food@goaloutnow.com. Thanks to every single one of you. And starting off with Jamie in Derry. Hi, Gary. Hi, Gareth. I want to try making my own pasta, but I've no fancy machine. Can I do it by hand or am I dreaming?
You're not dreaming at all. You need a rolling pin, but...
Mm-hmm.
You do need a rolling pin. Like
you need the triceps of an Italian granny.
Yeah, exactly. And look, there's loads of pasta recipes out there. So generally, I would say try and find one. Like you need to make about 500 grams of pasta. You do need to go out and get some 00 or Tipo flour, it's called. Has really high gluten content. those two little things are worth it. And I would say pick a recipe that has more egg yolks in it.
So good eggs. Yeah, essential. Eggs. Yeah, yeah. Orange.
And, yeah, yeah, exactly. That's what gives it a nice colour. And then you basically, if you have a little RoboCoop or a little mixer, you can make it on that, or the whole thing can be made by hand. You don't need a pasta machine, but you do need to let the, after you made the dough, let it rest for at least an hour wrapped in cling film. And then just start rolling it out. And then when you've got it, like, get it as thin as you can. If you've got a hard work surface at home,
yeah.
If you have got, you know, solid worktops, that's the place to do it. And then just roll it out and then roll the pasta up so as if you're making like a roly-poly, and just get your knife. And if you want tagliatelle, you do like a centimetre and a half. And then if you want linguine, you go a little bit shorter. If you want angel hair, you go shorter again. And then a pot of boiling salted water, drop it in.
There it is.
Toss it with a bit of pesto or a bit of olive oil and a bit of lemon and garlic.
It's really worth the effort. Cool thing, like,
this is a stupid question. Where do you get good eggs? Like, if you're living in a
good
town,
eggery.
So yeah, no, like, you have to go to, like,
yeah, I mean,
honestly, right, especially, well, I live in the countryside, so I have a couple of houses that have honesty boxes outside them. Like, honestly, free range. I mean, I'm blessed. I've O'Halloran's eggs in Longford. Like, surely I've bought my eggs off Shirley since 2008 when I moved to the Midlands. But just go with a really good free range egg, large eggs and egg yolks. Like, so whatever your recipe calls for, you're only using the yolks.
And if you've only got access to a supermarket, like, if you're not living and you haven't, you know, I would say the eggs are.
But they all have good eggs. Like,
oh, the eggs are good there, are they?
And I.
Like, Super Value have Shirley's eggs.
Like, yeah, yeah. And I like using the corn fed ones. So, because normally the egg is even, the yolk is a little bit more yellow.
So it does make a difference buying the
corn
fed.
It'll make a difference between two reasons. Flavor will be one, because they're more creamy,
okay,
and then it'll give you like more yellow pasta,
more color. Yeah,
there's a trick you can do where you can put a little bit of saffron into your egg yolk, which can lift the color of pasta if you're making a saffron pasta. But if you get caught by the bug of making pasta, before you know it, you'll be trying to make raviolis. You pick up a pasta machine online for less than 100 quid.
They're not dear, like, you know,
No, they're a lot of fun.
Great stuff. Good luck with that, Jamie in Derry. We've got Tomas and Skibbereen. Hiya, Gary and Gareth. What's one underrated Irish ingredient that more of us should be using? I want to shake up my weekly shop a bit. Thank you so much. Love the pod.
Beef tallow, possibly. Fat. Back in the day when we were younger, like, we used to call them home danglers.
I know he was going to ask that question, man. You rattled that one out pretty quick.
Yeah.
No, sure. Yeah. How would I know? beef tallow, yeah. We used to
hard to find.
Used to cook your chips always in blocks of fat. Do you remember, Ed? There's the nod. There's the nod.
I'm smelling it. Old boy.
I know how to massage out the old memory
there
in Ed.
It is.
You know, bring up a fried egg to that man, and he pops.
Oh yeah.
And
back there now.
Get some blocks of Irish beef tallow or beef fat, melt it, and then let's just a little quick Morris paper, wash them. Skin on, cut them into chips, into a pot, cold water, loads of salt, bring it to the boil, down to a simmer until they're 3/4 of the way cooked, strain them off, back in the pot and on the heat. Give the pot a couple of wee dabs to team them. We've talked about that before. We're going to dry the chips, fluff them, then lay them out in a bit of parchment paper flat till they cool completely, and then one drop at 130 degrees, lift them, turn the temperature of your fat fryer up to 170, and then drop them, blanch them first 130, then you fry them till crispy, toss them in fine sea salt. And if you have rosemary, really, really finely chop a teaspoon of rosemary, mulled and rock salt and rosemary fries, cooked in Irish beef tallow. Get back to me.
Big bowl of béarnaise now, and you're like, you're in food heaven.
Get up out of that yard.
What an answer. Thank you, and best of luck with that as well, Tomas in Skibbereen. Here we go. Kev in Longford. Hello, Gary. Hello, Gareth. Absolutely love the pod. Serious question now, though. Is there any way to make tofu taste like literally anything other than sadness?
No. Next question.
Or should I just give up and stick to chips? Is there anything you can do with tofu?
I think, like, the only way, like, silken tofu, if it is marinated and then deep fried and put through a stir fry, it's quite good. But
stir fry a beef and
yeah. I do think it's a tricky ingredient to work with for anybody.
Is it hard to cook with?
No, like there's a couple of different varieties of it. So like if you buy the ones that are too firm, they kind of taste a bit spongy. If you buy the ones that are too soft, they kind of break up a little bit. And look, I was actually speaking to somebody quite recently about Japanese cookery in general. And there's so much skill around it. But they were telling me they were over in Japan and they had some silken tofu in a restaurant that was just very lightly poached and dressed in a very high quality soya sauce, and they were like, they were saying it was up there one of the best food memories they've ever had.
Wow.
I don't have that experience of it. I cooked a lot of it when I lived in Australia, and how we used to work it was we used to cut it up and, as I said, toss it in a tiny little bit of flour, deep fry it, which kind of held it together, and then it went through a very quick stir fry. And it's, look, it's nice in that aspect. It's also very good in, like, if you have a laksa or a tom yum goong or any of those brothy type things, because it can be a little bit sponge-like. So if you have a really delicious soup and you put some...
It'll soak up.
Does it take on flavour well? I actually have no experience of working with it.
There's not a lot of flavour in it. Like,
no.
It's the texture you're...
It's soybean that and it's like it's a whey, right, that's being cut up and you know, strained or whatever. So when you put it into, like, if you have a really good soup, if you're in a good Thai restaurant or if you're in a good Japanese restaurant and they give you a really high flavored soup and there's tofu in it, if you didn't know it was there, you probably wouldn't know what it was. To eat it on its own, as I said, I believe when it's made really fresh in Japan, and you have it, as I said, dressed with a little bit of a very high quality soya sauce, it's supposed to be a very delicious thing. I think most Europeans' experience of it will be the stuff that comes in a carton and you slide it out. And so that probably answers it a little bit.
Really,
it just takes on a bit of flavour, Kev, so don't be afraid to jazz it up.
Give it a go. Give it a go, Kev. And thanks to everyone for all their great suggestions and questions into food at goloudnow.com. Keep them coming, and we'll have more kitchen conundrums or culinary conundrums next week.
Okay, so that's another episode done and dusted. Check out at Gar Mullins and at Gazza Chef on Instagram, the Go Loud page as well, where all the clips are there. Like it, share it, pass it on to a buddy. It always helps the boys get the word out there about the show. Thanks for tuning in. It was a good one today, Gaz. Santina was good crack.
She was brilliant. And in true hospitality style, she brought us some gifts.
Yes, give us a wee goodie bag. Let that be a warning to the rest of you. that we invite on this show. You better come double fisted for the boys.
Triple fisted.
Triple fisted. Yeah. Head chef sitting here. No mates.
Without a goodie bag.
Without a goodie bag. Santina, hang your head. Take care.
Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Subscribe for free on the Go Loud app and never miss an episode.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.